It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson's here. He was all set to talk about the Memcache exploit spreading like wildfire. That was the culprit in those DDoS attacks, huge DDoS attacks last week. But then, all of a sudden, some significant flaws were revealed in the AMD chipsets. And Steve decided he was going to do a deep dive on that. Lots more security news, too. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 654, recorded Tuesday, March 13th, 2018. AMD chipset disaster. Security Now is brought to you by IT Pro TV, binge-worthy learning for IT pros. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers or malicious insiders on your network with honeypots that can be deployed in minutes. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. And by Cloud Spanner from Google Cloud Platform. Cloud Spanner is the only horizontally scalable and strongly consistent relational database service. To learn more, visit g.co/getspanner today. It's time for Security Now, the show where we protect you and your loved ones online. This is becoming one of our biggest and best shows, and it's thanks to this guy right here, Steve Gibson of GRC.com. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Leo. Great to be with you again, as always. For our 654th episode of Security Now, I had intended for this to be a follow-up on last week's disclosure and discussion of the big mem-cached, huge, record-breaking 1.7 terabyte distributed reflection denial-of-service attacks. And then something even worse happened. So I was going to call this, you know, mem crashed update or something. And I have all of the sort of like what's happened since last week, which is a lot on that front. And then this morning, a research firm, a security research firm in Tel Aviv, who gave AMD 24, count them, 24 hours of notice.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Dropped a major bomb that they had found 13 remotely exploitable vulnerabilities in the chipset that AMD uses to sort of offload its security stuff. It's sort of like the Secure Enclave, and also just a chipset that's like a glue chipset. Anyway, the podcast was pretty much assembled, and you know, and everything was in place. And I thought, okay, good. And then, because the press release hit and the internet went nuts. And then I was thinking, okay, well, there's not time to know about all this yet, so let's just do that next week. But as I kept reading it like getting into more of this. And the whole research paper is online, so there was nothing I couldn't find out. And it's like, oh, we can't wait. So this suddenly got renamed from mem crashed update to the AMD chipset disaster, which surprisingly is not hyperbole. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So we're going to discuss the just released news of major trouble for AMD's chipset security, and the only possible mitigating factor I can imagine is that maybe there aren't many of them out there, except I think there are, because they're embedded and their laptop and their server and their enterprise, and it's like, ouch. But we're also going to talk about ISPs in the in East Asia have been found actively spreading state-sponsored malware, that is ISPs themselves. A note about Windows 10S that I noted you and Mary Jo and Paul were talking about last week. I just wanted to let our listeners know about Microsoft's announcement about 10S. We've got a large pile of cryptocurrency mining-driven shenanigans because, of course, there's money in them thar hills, and so you're going to have some shenanigans. Also, tomorrow is our annual Pwn2Own competition start, but there's some news about that and a bit of a twist about a set of contestants that will no longer be appearing. I have some surprising stats, I mean stunning stats, about where our spam is coming from, and then we will finally get to what was going to be the topic of the of this week, but now it's got pushed down the stack, and that's an update on the Memcached distributed reflection denial of service attacks and what's going on with them. And in fact, that's our picture of the week that we'll talk about in a second. So I think, yes, another interesting and for owners of AMD-based systems, maybe a little frightening.
Is it the newer Ryzen systems or is it older AMD?
Yes.
It's Ryzen systems.
The Ryzen and the Epics, I think is that the way you pronounce it.
I think a lot of people bought these Ryzen systems. That's not good.
Yeah.
Well, stay tuned. The thrilling and gripping details of the latest bad news exploit coming up in a second. Before we go there, let me go here. IT Pro TV. I love IT Pro TV. I know many of you do. In fact, pretty much every time somebody comes to watch Security Now, almost always they say, oh, and by the way, I love IT Pro TV. That's how I got my job in IT, or that's how I keep my job in IT. IT Pro TV was started by two great guys, Tim and Don. They were IT trainers for a long time. They did all the, you know, IT training stuff in classrooms, that kind of thing. They saw what we were doing. Look at this. They're doing right now MCSA servers, configuring failover clusters. It's that kind of stuff. If you think we're geeky, IT Pro TV is geek squared. Tim and Don have found their niche. What they do is 125 hours a week of live programming. They've got a chat room just like we do in every area of IT training. And then, just like us, those shows then become... There's Don right there. Then become, it's Brian. So they have a great team of people. Very fun, entertaining, interesting people. See, there's my bobblehead behind him. then become hours of on-demand training in every area of IT. I mean, they have certified ethical hacker, how to use Kali Linux, how to configure, set up, maintain AWS, the ITIL, and ISC squared security certificates. There are so many job openings right now in IT. If you were getting out of school and you were asking me, what should I do? And I thought, and you said, I like computers. I'd say, go to itpro.tv, find something you love and learn all about it. They have Transcender practice exams with a premium subscription so you can practice the test before you take the test. They have virtual labs. You don't even need a Windows server to learn how to use a Windows server. I love IT Pro TV. And you will too. That's the point. It's entertaining. You get flexible training on your schedule. You get binge-worthy content in the subjects you care about the most, the stuff you want to learn the most, and of course, ROI proven. Lots of teams use IT Pro TV to keep on their IT skills. I know many companies that have signed up for accounts. And the IT Pro training portal is great for groups because you can get a demo of it. If you go there and request a demo of the IT Pro TV for Teams on the website, you'll be very impressed. You control everything that's going on with your team's training schedule. You can create custom groups and training assignments. You can get analytics on individuals and the group as a whole. It's really great. So here's the deal. IT Pro TV... If you go to itpro.tv/security now, that's the website, itpro.tv/security now, You can request a free team trial, as you can see on the right, or if you use the offer code SN30, you can sign up for an individual monthly membership. You'll get a 7-day free trial, so you can try before you buy, and 30% off your subscription if you do decide to buy for the lifetime of your active subscription. 30% off. Premium subscriptions, which include unlimited Transcender practice exams, those are worth $100 by themselves. Virtual labs, normally that's $857 a year. Use that offer code, you'll only pay $600 a year. itpro.tv/securitynow. Take advantage of the 30% off offer with the offer code SN30. Flexible training, binge-worthy content, ROI proven, 90,000 members, and most of them are listeners to this show, itpro.tv/securitynow. If you love Steve and you love security and you love IT, it's just it's a fit made in heaven. Steve?
So our picture of the week was going to tie into the title of the podcast.
Didn't have time for a second illustration. Huh?
Changed at the last minute. Okay, but get this. More than 15,000 memcached DDoS attacks were aimed at 7,100 sites in just the last 10 days.
This can't all be the same person, right?
No, and this is the problem is that there are, we're not exactly sure how many, but at least 17,000 open, reflectable, memcached servers, which anyone on the internet can use. And as we'll be talking about, if we survive till the end of the podcast, there are now easy-to-use tools where you'd enter an IP address, and it goes and finds available memcached servers from Shodan and starts filling them up and sending them reflection UDP packets. I mean, it was no exaggeration a week ago when, you know, we made the podcast about this, because this is without question the most potent class of DDoS attacks we've yet encountered. It is due to the fact that a tiny query can produce a massive response, which can be spoofed. The amplification factor, and we've talked about amplification factors of, oh my God, 200. And, you know, so you send in 10 bytes and you get 2,000. Woo! Okay. This amplification factor on these memcached DDoS attacks is 51,000.
So for every byte, you get 51K.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And anyway, so we'll come back to this at the end of the podcast. But what this is demonstrating is that this is all, I mean, if anything could have pulled hackers' attention away from crypto jacking, it would be a DDoS attack capability that is this juicy and potent and capable. So it's like, great. So I'm sure we'll be talking about it next week. We'll, you know, the industry is trying to rally itself, but as we know, there are servers scattered all over the internet. Many of them are unattended. Many of them are in closets and have been forgotten, and no one is paying any attention to them. And they'll just happily accept huge blobs of data and then send them out on request. So, yeah. Anyway, there's lots of more news that we will get to at the end of the podcast. But what preempted that as our main focus.
This would be pretty bad if it preempted that.
So a brand new, the very first coverage confused this with Spectre and Meltdown, and this has nothing to do with Spectre and Meltdown. We know that AMD chips have never been susceptible to the Meltdown problem, but that they do need some microcode fixes in order to help them mitigate the Spectre problem. So there's that. but a brand new, completely different, and kind of and just coincidental timing set of 13 critical flaws have just been reported to affect AMD's Ryzen and EPYC processors. You may want to pull up this site, amdflaws.com. These people are not being shy about their reporting. They've got
registered a domain name. They're serious.
They registered a
They're
domain.
Serious.
They've got graphics artists at work. They've got videos. They've got facts.
But this is not AMD. This is the group that discovered it.
Correct.
Is that
so
right?
The group is CTS Labs. Oh, and you can imagine AMD is not happy right now. They were given, as I mentioned at the top of the show, one day, 24 hours notice of this all going public.
But this has a good name, which means it's going to spread like wildfire. Because it's all about the name, right?
It's
Ryzen Fall. I like it.
That's actually a brilliant name. So the group is CTS Labs. They're an Israeli Tel Aviv-based team of researchers. Their press release dated March 13th, which is today, 10 a.m. Eastern, said CTS Labs, a cybersecurity research firm and consultancy, today released a severe security advisory on Advanced Micro Devices, Inc. processors. A CTS Labs security audit, they write, revealed multiple critical security vulnerabilities and manufacturer backdoors in AMD's latest EPYC, that's EPYC, Ryzen, Ryzen Pro, and Ryzen Mobile processors. Now, technically, these are in the chipsets, that is the supporting chips, but we'll get to that in a second. These vulnerabilities have the potential to put organizations at significantly increased risk of cyber attacks. CTS Labs has produced a white paper report further detailing these vulnerabilities, available at amdflaws.com. And there's like several offers on that page to download the white paper, which of course I did and spent some time with it. CTS Labs has also shared this information with, editorially, yesterday, AMD, Microsoft, HP, Dell, and select security companies, in order that they may work on developing mitigations and patches and examine and research these and other potential vulnerabilities at the company. That is to say, AMD. CTS Labs has also shared this information with relevant U.S. regulators. CTS Labs, they write, is a cybersecurity research firm and consultancy based in Tel Aviv, Israel, specializing in hardware and embedded system security. For more information about CTS Labs, please see cts-labs.com. Okay, so as I've said, the vulnerabilities don't affect AMD's Zen CPU cores themselves, but rather two different chips that are part of the Ryzen and EPYC system set. The first is the ARM-based AMD Secure processor, which, as I mentioned before, is kind of like their equivalent of the Secure Enclave. And the second is known as the Promontory chipset, which is produced by Taiwanese subcontractor AS Media. And these people are not happy about the work that AS Media, that is CTS Labs, is unhappy about that. So all there has been so far from AMD, because, I mean, this just happened, is that AMD responded, quote, "At AMD, security is a top priority, and we're continually working to ensure the safety of our users as new risks arise daily." They continue, "We are investigating this report, which we just received, to understand the methodology and merit of the findings." And so I need to say also that my first reaction upon seeing this was, okay, wait, maybe we should hold off saying anything. That would mean a week delay rather than a day delay. And so I thought, well, no, the best that could happen is that it turns out that this is wrong. But this, it seems, the more I looked at it and dug into their research, the more credible and verifiable this appeared. Okay, so what happened? 13 critical security vulnerabilities and what they describe as manufacturer backdoors were discovered throughout AMD, Ryzen, and EPYC product lines. In their little Q&A that is on at the AMDflaws.com site, they said, "Am I affected?" And the answer, any consumer or organization purchasing AMD servers, workstations, or laptops are affected by these vulnerabilities. And of course, we have to back that off a little bit and say if they contain these affected chipsets. And so they said the site is to inform the public about the vulnerabilities and call upon AMD and the security community to fix the vulnerable products. Well, I doubt that much calling upon will be necessary. But they have another site, safefirmware.com, where the white paper can be found at /AMDflaws_whitepaper.pdf. So there are a total of 4 vulnerabilities, 3 in firmware and 1 in hardware. And this Chimera is the 4th hardware vulnerability, which is unfixable, they claim, because it is a hardware problem. It is something, apparently, a backdoor built into, presumably by this AMD subcontractor, we'll get to in a second. The other 3, there's Rise and Fall, there's Fallout, and Master Key, are firmware vulnerabilities, which presumably can be fixed. These guys in their research did succeed in rewriting the firmware remotely of this firmware reprogrammable outboard chip that does the security, and were able to install persistent threats into the firmware. So it looks to me like the biggest problem, I mean, just in terms of practical remediation, is with Chimera. And so they write, backdoors inside Ryzen chipset. The Chimera vulnerabilities are an array of hidden manufacturer backdoors inside AMD's Promontory chipsets. These chipsets are an integral part of all Ryzen and Ryzen Pro workstations. There exist 2 sets of backdoors differentiated by their implementation. One is implemented, within the firmware running on the chip, while the other is inside the chip's ASIC, ASIC hardware. Because the latter has been manufactured into the chip, a direct fix may not be possible, and the solution may involve either a workaround or a recall. The backdoors outlined in this section, I'm reading from their paper, provide multiple pathways for malicious code execution inside the chipset's internal processor. Because the chipset is a core system component, running malware inside the chip could have far-reaching security implications. The diagram below, and they have a diagram in their PDF that basically shows the Ryzen CPU connected to this big red box, red because bad, where like everything, all of the I/O in the system is going there. The LAN and the Wi-Fi and the USB. I mean, it's the switchboard for the CPU. So it says the diagram below was taken from the instruction manual of ASUS Crosshair 6 Hero Ryzen motherboard. It can be seen that not only is the chipset connected to the computer's USB, SATA, and PCIe ports, which is to say pretty much everything. It is also linked to the computer's LAN, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth. In our research, they write, we've been able to execute our own code inside the chipset and then leverage the latter's direct memory access engine, the DMA engine, to manipulate the operating system running on the main processor. These two capabilities form the foundation for malware and provide a proof of concept. We believe that with additional research, a determined attacker, who of course now knows where to look, may also be able to reach the following capabilities. And so they tick off a keylogger. It may be possible to implement a stealthy keylogger by listening to USB traffic that flows through the chipset. Network access. It may be possible to implement network-based malware by leveraging the chipset's position as a middleman for the machine's LAN, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth. Bypass memory protection. It may be possible to leverage the chipset's position to access protected memory areas such as the system management RAM. They say, we have verified this works on a small set of desktop motherboards. So they have a second section that I'm sharing just because it's inflammatory but worrisome. Third-party chip design plagued with hidden backdoors is the topic for this. They said in November 2014, it was announced that AMD signed a contract with the Taiwanese chip manufacturer AS Media, according to which AS Media would design 12 AMD's chipset for the upcoming Zen processor series. This chipset, codenamed Promontory, plays a central role within the company's latest generation Ryzen and Ryzen Pro workstations. It is responsible for linking the processor to external devices such as hard drives, USB devices, PCIe cards, and occasionally also network Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. Although it is branded AMD, the Promontory chipset is not based on AMD technology. Rather, it is an amalgamation of several integrated circuits that AS Media has been selling to OEMs for years, all merged together onto a single silicon die. And okay, so and I'm skipping a whole bunch where they really tear AS Media apart, saying that the chips that were glued together have a long history of problems. They exist on other motherboards and may themselves be problems. But essentially, the essence is that AS Media just pulled a bunch of their existing stuff, kind of threw it together, stuck it on a die, and said, "Here you go." And so, in their Q&A, they ask, "Doesn't this publication put users at risk?" And I would argue their statement, no, they say. All technical details that could be used to reproduce the vulnerabilities have been redacted from this publication. They say CTS has shared this information with AMD, Microsoft, and a small number of companies that could produce patches and mitigations. On the other hand, we know from a practical standpoint that telling the world 24 hours after you revealed this to AMD, there's just no way that that's not irresponsible. At a minimum, 90 days to allow AMD or a week to allow AMD to evaluate it independently, come to their own conclusions and produce a response. Not even that courtesy was given. So it's very difficult not to hold these people responsible for, to some degree, to any damage which occurs as a consequence of the fact that it's not possible to expect anyone to react in 24 hours to this kind of disclosure. And I mean, and this is an outboard chipset. We know very little about it at this point. I'm sure I'll have a follow up next week. The good news is they did not release, I mean, thank goodness, proof of concept or additional details. The problem is that the world now knows, the hacker world now knows, there is a big juicy target here, and there's now a race to see whether there's any remediation that can be done. Then that has to get created and has to get somehow pushed out to the affected motherboards, while in parallel, bad guys are working to figure out what it was that CTS has figured out and leverage it before that can happen. So anyway, you know, there's no takeaway for our listeners, nothing we can do at this point. I have a bunch of AMD-based machines. I'm largely an Intel shop, but I have AMD because, you know, that they're a strong source of 64-bit systems, as we know. So I will just be following this news and, of course, keep our listeners informed. The good news is it's not clear what role Microsoft could play. We do know that Microsoft has an active patchable channel, a patching channel. As we talked last week, they've started to use that to patch the Intel microcode. This is outboard microcode, so this will be microcode of that chipset. So it's not clear to me what the path is for getting that fixed. Maybe, you know, if there's access to it from the main CPU, then that is programmatic access, then presumably AMD could produce and Microsoft could push a patch for Windows users at least. And of course, Windows is not the only OS to run on AMD chips. Maybe we'll see something happen in the Linux community even before. I mean, who knows? We'll be watching it closely because this is you know, as you commented, Leo, at the top of the show, when you heard it was the Ryzen family that were affected, you know, this has got to be really bad news for AMD. I'm disappointed, frankly, that CTS did this. It would have been much more reasonable for them to give AMD some time to respond. For example, for a remediation and a patch to be available in the channel, and for these guys to say, okay, we're the people who found this. I don't understand why that didn't
unless
happen.
They felt like it was going to be imminently come out in other ways or.
Yeah, good point. Yep.
I mean, there are reasons you might want to make it go public as soon as possible.
Well, nothing could possibly put AMD under more pressure. So yeah. If there was any sense that they weren't going to be listened to, that AMD was blowing them off, that, you know, that it wasn't going to get fixed in, you know, like as you said, maybe they do have some information about about something else going on that really makes this have to happen as fast as possible. We just don't know yet. So I imagine more information will be coming, and we'll of course keep our listeners in the loop.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Not what you want to have happen.
I guess this means you shouldn't buy an AMD processor for a while. I mean, there are people in the chat room who say, gosh, I was going to go get one today.
Yeah,
I would wait a little while at least to hear what mitigations there are. Maybe it's not a real threat, and maybe AMD will come out and say, oh, we've analyzed this. It's not a real threat, or I don't know.
Yeah,
it's not like Intel doesn't have its own problems, right?
Right, and maybe I mean most of this is firmware updatable, apparently, except for the hardware variant of the Chimera flaw, and we don't know that you can't work around that with firmware to maybe shut down something. Maybe it means you have to turn off one of your USB ports, or who knows, but. It would be difficult, yes, Leo, to go and lay money out right now. Well, but it's also a function of your exposure. If it's, if it's your own machine.
Do we know what the mechanism for an attack would be? Does it?
No, we don't yet. Although, based on what little we know, it looks like because this chipset is like that outboard chip, this Promontory chip, which is where the problems are. It is the glue for all the I/O. So, hard drive, LAN, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth. I mean, you name it. It has access into the chip. Though, again, we don't know how it is that you leverage this. And the good news is, I mean, AMD just must be gasping right now. I'm sure within the next day or two, because I'm sure they're motivated to help create some AMD side calibration, we should know more. And so, you know, maybe wait just a couple days and see what AMD says. If they're able to say, okay, definitively, you know, this is only a local attack through USB block, you know, that kind of thing, then you would probably, and if they're able to say, and we've got a fix on the way, then I'd say, yeah, fine, you know, go ahead.
Yeah.
Wow.
Poor Aunt Pruitt just got his a week ago. But it doesn't necessarily mean this is panic time for you either as a user.
No, well, and here we are, what is it? It's the middle of March, and we've been talking about Spectre meltdown all year, and there still isn't a, you know, a widespread known exploit of that.
Right.
And so, it's not, you know, we're 10 weeks in. And the good news, I mean, if there's an upside, it's that this couldn't possibly motivate AMD any more strongly.
Right.
And no doubt AS Media is saying, you know, whoops.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I even wonder, whoops, or did they get caught up to no good, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
If you put a back door into these chips.
If it's really a hardware back door, it's very hard that AMD was unaware of, that AMD didn't ask for.
This may not be AMD's fault. Probably those, at least, are not AMD's fault. Probably ASM just did it. Is ASM in mainland China?
They're Taiwanese.
Okay,
yes.
So not Taiwan. That's different.
So not mainland, but yeah. You know, who knows?
I would be suspicious of mainland Chinese manufacturers because they could easily be subverted by the government, whether they wanted to or not.
Well, in fact, we've got a couple stories about what's happening with China today. So we'll be talking about that in a second. So yes, you're certainly right. One thing that is a little disturbing. This doesn't affect people outside of Turkey, Syria, and Egypt, but from a technology capability standpoint, it is worrisome because it could affect us all. And that is that ISPs in those three countries have been caught using, I'm annoyed with this term, deep packet inspection. All it really means is hardware which is operating at the packet level, that is, you know, it's not just a router which is looking at packet headers and sending things around. It's going into the packet in order to see what's going on. It turns out that there is a company, Sandvine, which has a line of hardware called the Packet Logic devices, which Sandvine argues are not designed for this purpose, and they're not happy that they've been called out and having been found.
We should point out that there are ISPs who use Sandvine for deep packet inspection. And yes. I think it was Comcast, it was one of the US ISPs, was using it to block BitTorrent.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, Citizen Lab are the researchers who caught this behavior and reported their findings to Sandvine, which says that Citizen Labs, who I strongly believe is correct, report is false, misleading, and wrong, and demanded that Citizen Lab returned to them the secondhand packet logic device, which Citizen Lab used to confirm the attribution of the network fingerprint that the Sandvine devices were using. So looks to me like Citizen Lab did everything right. So here's what they found. Turkey's telecom network, which had some overlap in Syria, so thus some Syrian ISPs were involved, or Syrian citizens at least, were using Sandvine's packet logic devices to redirect hundreds of targeted users. So not everybody, but if you were a known customer of Turkey Telecom, so for example, journalists, lawyers, and human rights defenders, your typical targets in those environments, to malicious versions of legitimate programs bundled, and those programs were bundled with Finn Fisher and another spyware or malware known as Strong Pity. When they tried to download them from official sites. Now, that's what's interesting, is unfortunately, there are a number of sites, many of which are HTTPS. But when you go to download their software, the download link is HTTP. So what happens is you're at a legitimate site, and we're talking, for example, Avast antivirus, CCleaner, unfortunately got caught up in this again, and remember that they were a victim of some compromise not too many months back. Opera and 7-Zip. Those sites, at least at the time of this reporting, were downloading their software over non-HTTPS. So you would, even if you went to those sites over HTTPS, so you knew you were there, the download link was not. So what this packet logic device allowed was that to be intercepted, since without TLS, without being in a TLS tunnel, you have no authentication of the connection. And that caused the otherwise legitimate links and their programs to be funneled from another source undetected, and people believed they had done the right thing. They believed they were at the legitimate site, but the actual software they received had been tampered with. So that's the case in Turkey. In Egypt, the same Sandvine packet logic devices were being used by an Egyptian ISP to make money in two different ways. One, they were secretly, the ISP was injecting cryptocurrency mining script into every HTTP web page their own users, their own customers visited in order to mine Monero cryptocurrency. So again, non-HTTPS, the Sandvine packet logic devices were unable to deal with that due to its encryption, but the second you dropped out of HTTPS, as soon as you just started using a plain text connection, then they were able to manipulate your traffic. And in this case, add some cryptocurrency mining JavaScript into any non-HTTPS websites that their customers visited. And they were also redirecting some users to web pages with affiliate ads as another way of generating additional revenue. So anyway, as far as we know, that's not happening to users outside of those countries, but it is a real heads up that there's a vulnerability which is exploitable. We know has been exploited, if not against us, at least theoretically, well, it has been exploited against, you know, against those customers, those targeted customers, leveraging the fact that the that without TLS encryption on the connection, you are still subject to manipulation, even if you're at an otherwise HTTPS site. And boy, we have to, maybe it's because they're using content delivery networks. They're using a CDN that doesn't offer HTTPS services. I've not looked any further to see, for example, why legitimate companies like Avast, CCleaner, Opera, and 7-Zip might be offering non-HTTPS content in some cases. It's worth keeping an eye on. And Leo, speaking of that, we've been moving along, and we're ready for break number two.
At a rapid clip, haven't we? Have I shown you my honeypot lately? It was the very first subject of this show 13 years ago, were honey monkeys.
Honey monkeys.
Yeah.
Yep.
But honeypots have come a long way since honey monkeys. This is a canary from Thinkst, Thinkst. I've talked about this before. I'm really a fan of these. This one is in operation, so I can show you a little bit. The idea is you get these Thinkst canaries, you put them on your network, and they don't look like honeypots. They look like whatever it is you set them up to look like, whether it's a router. Yeah, they can look like routers and switches. Of course, NAS servers, always popular. They can pose like a ReadyNAS or a Synology NAS or a whole variety. It could look like a Linux box that somebody just left online. No protection at all. Or a Linux server. It's up to you. You set up the Thinkst canary. Let me show you the interface so you can see. It will tell you if there is anybody accessing it. So you can see I have a number of tokens. I'll tell you about that in a bit. Those are files that you create with your Thinkst canary. They look like Word documents or PDFs. You might make one, a PDF that you put on your accountant system that says salary and social security numbers, something like that, salary info. It's the kind of thing hackers, you know, might even say, well, but I got to open it. I got to open it. And as soon as they do, you know. Thinkst has been in the security game for nearly two decades. They've trained companies, militaries, governments, both on how to break in networks and how to protect networks. This is a really good price, especially when you consider what you're going to get. If Target had had these, and actually one of the things that's great about the Thinkst is they roll up all the alerts. So here's an incident. HTTP login attempt on backup NAS. So this is a NAS that I created, fake NAS. It's just the canary, to look like a Synology. Somebody tried to log into this 9 times. Let's see some more details. Here is all the information about the login, the IP address it came from, even the user agent string, the user name and password. That can be useful because if they use a name of somebody in your company, that means an attacker might know more. Notice that I can mark those as unseen. I can mark them deleted. I can copy the incident link and share it. And because they roll up incidents, you don't get a ton of alerts. You get one high-quality alert when it matters via phone, text, email, whatever you choose. And that's important. You know, Target had some kind of simple monitoring devices on their network before they were breached. But most of it, I think some of it was from Zanvine. Most of it had been turned off because it's too many notifications. I don't want to, yes, you're bothering me. Stop pinging me. You really want those notifications. So it's good that the notifications are simple, straightforward, and to the point. You can configure the canary in a whole bunch of different ways. This is kind of fun. Name it what you want. Say where the location is. Pick a personality. You can say a bear canary with no services or a Christmas tree. That means it lights up like a Christmas tree, which means a hacker, when they do a port scan, will go, whoa. Sometimes you don't want to do that. Here's Windows Server 2012, 2008, 2000. How about let's make a nice Windows XP desktop file share. That's always good for a laugh. SharePoint, IIS, you've got Linux choices, standard Linux server, Linux database, Linux proxy. You can have an OS X file share. I can go on and on. I mean, it's unlimited. You can even be a SCADA device. Remember the centrifuges in Iran that were hacked? Why don't you be a Siemens Seamatic 300 PLC? You can look like a SCADA device. And that is such an attractive thing to have for some certain kinds of attackers. You'll know which one you need. You can say what the fingerprint will be, which operating system, Cisco, Rockwell, Dell, Mac, Windows. You can have your own Mac prefix. So that's how people know what the hardware is, right? Well, this is a Rockwell automation. It's a Siemens AG industrial automation device. Yeah, that's it. So it spoofs the Mac address. It basically is indistinguishable in every way from a real one of those, whatever it is. Here's the services you can turn on. And once you have that new configuration set up, it looks just like that to a hacker. It looks like whatever it's posing as. You can have as many as you want. It's affordable because you get five of these hardware canaries. So you can have five devices spread out over your network, all different kinds. Your own hosted console, you get upgrades, support, and maintenance for a full year, just $7,500. Every corporation should have one of these. And the other thing it does that I love is these canary tokens. We talked about this on a show some years ago. Canary tokens are those documents that you can create from your canary, PDFs, Word documents, whatever. Make them juicy, make them delicious, put them all over your network. But when anybody tries to open one, you'll get an alert. That is fantastic. The canaries don't look vulnerable on your network. They look valuable. Attackers just can't resist them. And if this breaks or, you know, a truck falls on it or whatever, they'll just send you a new one. Easy peasy. Canary.tools/twit if you want to get more information. You can see them in action. They have free canary tokens there, but the advantage of having your own canary is the canary tokens phone home to your canary server, not the Thinx server. And if, you know, maybe somebody's paying attention, they might say, I'm going to block tokens from calling the Thinx server. They can't really block tokens in your own network. That's your network. So make as many tokens as you want. They're free, unlimited. It's such a great idea. Special offer for our audience. If you want a canary, or actually five canaries, and I really, if you're running a business, if you're running servers, if you're responsible for locking a network down and you're not using one of these, that's irresponsible. You ought to get one. Canary.tools/twit. Use the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box and you'll get 10% off the price. And not just for your first year, forever. We know you'll love your Thinx Canary. If you're not happy, of course. 60-day money-back guarantee. So there's no reason not to try the 60-day money-back guarantee. Try it. See how it works. Show the boss. And wait and see what happens when the hackers come a-calling. You'll know. You won't be like Sony Pictures Entertainment just sitting there. Yeah, I'm sure everything's fine. What could possibly have gone wrong? It's such a simple thing to do. Canary.tools/twit. These guys are great. I talked to Haroon and the team, and they're really, really cool. Canaries, everything they learned is pen testers or whatever nefarious things they were up to, they put into this. Canary.tools/twit. Use the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box, and we thank them so much for supporting the TWIT network and security now. And, of course, we've got, I'm just showing you one, we've got canaries everywhere. All over the place. Actually, I use the tokens. I don't have a canary at home, but I use the tokens at home. Put them on my NAS. Put them on my desktop. It's so simple. It's such a brilliant idea. Cool. All right, Stevie. Continue, my friend.
So, we've not talked about Windows 10S because we've not talked a lot about, you know.
We know what you think of Windows 10. We know what you think.
Yes, we do. So I did want to just mention so that it hadn't been ignored on this podcast that Microsoft has announced a change in their policy relative to Windows 10.
Paul would say this was what it always was, but they just didn't communicate it well.
Okay. And they're going now they are.
Yeah.
Last Wednesday evening. Is it the corporate vice president in charge of Windows? Is
Joe Belfiore? Yeah,
Fiori. Okay, yeah. Joe Belfiore. Yeah.
We call him Joey B. He's great.
Joey B.
Yeah.
He wrote a short blog post to describe what's happening that I'll just share for just so that we have it on the record here. So it was Windows 10 in S mode coming soon to all edition of Windows 10. And that's why I think it's relevant to our listeners, is that it's becoming a mode for Windows 10.
Right.
So he said, some of you may have seen a discussion around our plans for Windows 10S on Twitter today, speaking of last Wednesday. And given some additional questions I've received, he writes, I thought it might be helpful to share more about our plans with Windows 10S. Last year, we introduced Windows 10S, an effort to provide a Windows experience that delivers predictable performance and quality through Microsoft-verified apps via the Microsoft Store. This configuration was offered initially as part of the Surface Laptop and has been adopted by our customers and partners for its performance and reliability.
Yeah, I had that Windows Surface Laptop, and what they offered at the time was great. You could just push a button and turn into Windows 10 Pro.
Right, meaning you could un-S yourself.
Un-S yourself.
Yeah. Okay.
Kiss your S goodbye.
Yeah, that's right. And apparently everybody did.
Yeah.
They said since that time, well, and I've heard Paul say it was, you know, basically unusable. It was
I would disagree, but if you can't put Chrome on the things about S were it had to be, I think it had to be, you could only use store apps. I think they
correct,
had to be 32-bit.
Sure.
I can't remember that issue. But the
don't
problem
they have
is,
to be the UWP?
UWP, yeah. So
yep.
You couldn't use Chrome. You couldn't use LastPass. I mean, there was a lot of things. I guess you could use LastPass, but you couldn't use Chrome. You couldn't use, you know.
Well, anything else that you want to use
that wasn't in the store.
Yeah.
Right. So.
So. Yeah.
The real question, which we asked on the show, is
sort of like the Windows Phone of Windows.
Well, it wasn't that bad. You get most of the stuff. It's just the real thing is there really any benefit to it? Is it more secure? Is it faster? Does it have better battery life? That was never clear. That's what Microsoft asserted.
And what do you think their intent was? Because I've never really understood. I mean, did they want to create a monitored, managed enclave? Like,
no, it wasn't that sophisticated. That's the problem. It was basically Windows 10 where you couldn't get anything but what was in the store. Kind of like if you took your Mac and you said only allow apps from the App Store, which is a mode on OS 10.
That's probably what S stood for, was Windows 10 Store Edition.
Yeah, and I think it was to compete with the Chromebook. Even though the Surface Laptop was not inexpensive, I think it was assumed that all the other computers that ran Windows 10S would be for education, where you know you might want to lock it down, and for less expensive environments. It was to compete with the Chromebook. But the truth is, it was kind of a muddy product to begin with. And so considering it a service or a mode of Windows 10 makes more sense. If you had a switch, just like you do in OS 10, where you say, well, only allow people to buy stuff from the App Store, don't allow them to download.
Right.
It would be more secure, right? If you couldn't download stuff that wasn't in the App Store.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So
well,
that was
for
the
example,
idea.
I'm sure that everything in the App Store has been digitally signed.
Right.
And when I was talking just a minute ago about ISPs intercepting HTTP and doing packet level redirection in order to cause malicious code to get downloaded, I meant to say that just 2 days ago I was looking for, you know, because it's me, an old version of Adobe Reader. I don't want DC or 11 or any of the new nonsense where you have to sign up and subscribe and join and be a member. I just want a PDF to open. And so I ended up finding, I think it was a version 11 or maybe it was 9. Anyway, I found something that looked right, but it wasn't from Adobe. Since then, I've realized that the Adobe's FTP server does have everything that they ever did there. It's like, oh, thank goodness. But a couple days ago, I found one from what looked like a reputable download site. And of course, and I'm not recommending that anybody do that because I was lucky. I felt I was lucky to find it. What I downloaded was 35 megs and I was very careful not to run it. Instead, I checked to see if it was signed. And it was signed by Adobe. I verified the certificate. I verified the signature. I mean, I did all this other stuff that I know how to do, and I'm certain I know that our listeners know how to do. Most people don't, but the point is that's what you have to go through if because in our current world, there's just so much crap on the internet that is trying to take advantage of you. So it's certainly an advantage for a neophyte Windows user to, if you turn on S mode, then the Windows is certainly going to not let you download anything it's from other than the store, and anything from the store will be digitally signed by who knows,
at least presumably the publisher. Vetted, although the Microsoft store is an abomination, but it's kind of like this switch on Mac OS. Look, you know, allow apps downloaded from either App Store and identified developers. That means you have to have a certificate, or App Store. You can actually bypass this if you download something without a certificate, but you have to manually approve it. And if you put this in App Store and then locked it so that your kids or your users couldn't change it, that would be effectively S mode. That's Apple's version of S mode, and that's what I hope Microsoft does. I think that would be a good thing. I don't have a problem with that.
So his statement says, he says, since that time, that is of the time of the S on the Surface, that's probably what S stood for too, Surface and Store and Security and Stability and Safety and the American Way. Oh, no. Anyway, so
Microsoft always says it stands for nothing.
Okay. Since that time, he says, we've received great feedback from customers and partners on Windows 10S. Customers love the security, the faster boot time.
Please.
Oh, it makes it faster,
too. No, it doesn't, though. It's Windows 10 Pro. It's the same.
Right. Better battery life. Oh, it makes your battery life a lot lighter.
See, if any of this were true, it might make it worthwhile. But as far as I can tell, it's not.
Right. And he says, and consistent performance over time. What? Because you can't load anything.
Because you can't put crap on it.
Right.
Which is a real problem in the Windows world.
So he says, our partners have brought to market more than 20 devices with Windows 10S enabled. We've also heard feedback that the naming was a bit confusing for our customers and partners. And of course, we've done nothing to alleviate that confusion. Then he says, based on that feedback, we are simplifying. Oh, it stands for simplifying the experience for our customers, starting with the next update to Windows 10, which I did a little bit of research. Apparently, it's expected to be the spring. So maybe it stands for spring, the spring creators update, Windows 10 spring edition. Anyway, so with the Windows 10 Spring Creators Update, we believe, and he's saying starting with the next update to Windows 10 coming soon, customers can choose to buy a new Windows 10 Home or Windows 10 Pro PC with S mode enabled, and commercial customers will be able to deploy Windows 10 Enterprise with S mode enabled. He said, we expect the majority of customers to enjoy the many benefits. Okay, I said many. The benefits of Windows 10 in S mode. If a customer does want to switch out of S mode, they will be able to do so, Leo, at no charge. You won't be charged for getting all the rest of Windows back. Regardless of edition, we expect to see new Windows 10 devices ship with S mode available from our partners in the coming months. So check back here for updates.
I'm waiting for one, actually. It should come this week.
Uh-oh.
An HP.
Does that mean you can't turn it back on after you've been bad and turned it off?
You can, but it's not easy. You have to reinstall Windows 10 S mode.
Okay.
Because I did it on my Surface laptop. And then, by the way, I did it as an experiment because Paul wanted to know. I bought the Surface laptop with 10S on it, put up with 10S for a while, but said, no, I really want Chrome. And so I then flipped it off. It's very easy. It doesn't make many changes because, frankly, all it does is it says, go ahead, get stuff from the store. It's fine.
It just it loosens its grip.
It loosens its grip. Yeah. It's very quick. And that was free. And then as an experiment, we were curious, well, now that you've installed Chrome on it, if you go back to S mode, what happens to Chrome?
Yes, I'm curious,
and
too.
And that's why it takes so long. You have to download S mode, reinstall, and yes, Chrome is gone. So,
oh, it expunges.
It expunges.
Okay.
And I think that's why it's more complicated to switch it off and on. I would love to see a switch. See, what would be great is switch it off just like I can on the Mac, get Chrome, then switch it back on again.
And then leave me alone.
Right? That would be ideal.
Protect me, but forgive my past sins.
Exactly.
Yes.
That would be nice. We don't know what they're going to do.
S for sin mode. No.
Sin. Anyway. Sub-sin. Sinless.
So, for our listeners, something is coming with the spring creators update that will sort of, it'll be interesting. He talks about being able to turn it off. And I guess there were some rumors that you'd have to pay an extra $49 to turn it off. And
you used to have to.
Ah.
You
had to pay more?
Yeah, you had to pay $50 to go to Windows 10 Pro. So that was
Pro.
Yeah. Well, it is Pro, by the way. That may change, but it was.
Underneath the S.
It was always Pro.
A Pro hiding. Yeah.
And the deal with the laptop, Surface laptop, is you have till December, you know, the end of the year, and you can get it for free. And after that, it'll be $50. But I think they never really did that. I think they never really did that. It seemed like a good idea.
Okay.
Anyway, I don't know. I've given that laptop to Megan. My guess is it's not
so many
S
words
mode.
Start with S that it's just too much
I
fun.
Know. But I am getting one of these new Windows on ARM machines because I'm very curious what they'll be like running on a Qualcomm. Nothing wrong with Qualcomm chips, is there?
No. Nope. Sorry, you know. Although, apparently, that merger was blocked by
the
our president,
which is really interesting.
Yeah, citing cyber security or national security.
Yeah, because Broadcom's in Singapore, even though they were planning on repatriating to the U.S. We're in an old Broadcom facility, by the way. The studios was
got
Broadcom.
Great plumbing.
It was so easy to get the servers in and everything. It was great. Hello, China! Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. I don't know. He didn't give us any information about the justification except to say for security reasons. Singapore is a U.S. ally. Maybe he thinks Singapore is China. I don't know.
Okay, well, I'm just going to bite my
tongue.
And
whatever. Move on. Hey, we're safer. We're all safer.
So, we have an interesting collection of cryptocurrency / malicious mining crypto jacking news. I got a kick from a note that I saw on the Bleeping Computer site. Our friend Lawrence Abrams, who is the founder of Bleeping Computer, which is, as we and often mentioned on this podcast, terrific site. They were early the main source of really good information when the very first crypto malware, you know, the file encryption stuff happened. I think, you know, they were the people who were on the top of that news. So, you know, and then the so-called ransomware, right? So I got a kick out of this because he said, I think it was late last week, he said, it has been a pretty slow ransomware week as most of the malware developers have started pushing crypto miners. So there you have it from the site that has been at the forefront of ransomware. And as we've been saying, as soon as it became possible to monetize attacks in some other way, like mining, that's what happened. So here's Larry saying it's been a pretty slow ransomware week as most of the malware developers have switched to crypto mining. So in a different story there that sort of relates to that, they noted that Checkpoint Security did a study of the ranking of different malware. And in Bleeping Computer's coverage, they said 3 in-browser cryptocurrency mining scripts ranked 1st, 2nd, and 4th in Checkpoint's most active malware top 10. So across all malware, cryptocurrency mining is 3 of the top 4. and now outranks classic high-output malware distribution infrastructures such as spam botnets, malvertising, and exploit kit operations. That is, what is hip to do now is get your mining, get your mining address, your cryptocurrency address, into as many other people's machines as possible, steal their computation cycles, and participate in a pool and turn it into cash flow. So the number one, not surprisingly, the number one mining script is CoinHive. Number two is CryptoLoot that we have not yet encountered on this podcast. And number four is JSE Coin. So no doubt, you know, JavaScript Electric Coin. These three are online services, they write, that offer JavaScript libraries that website owners can embed on their sites and generate profit by using their visitors' CPU resources to mine Monero cryptocurrency. And they note that while all three as are legitimate, and, you know, CoinHive, I've been often quoted actually from this podcast, noting that I thought maybe they should really be held responsible because there's no way they don't know they're being abused. And we talked about, in fact, the explicit opt-in face of CoinHive on a different domain and asking people, please don't block us. We're really going to make sure people opt in. We're taking responsibility for the opt-in ourselves so that nobody can use our script from this domain without us making sure the user knows that's happening. That's really the only thing they could do at this point because, you know, they are a known domain that is being blocked by many of the ad blockers. So in Checkpoint's case, the company said that its security products, and this is surprising, but I guess this is a function of Checkpoint's demographic, their customer demographic. So they said that their security products have detected cryptojacking across 42% of the organizations they protect. 42% of Checkpoint's customers that are contracted to get Checkpoint security protection, 42% have had cryptojacking mining detected. CoinHive, of course, in the lead with detections found on 20% of all of Checkpoint's customers, followed by CryptoLoot in a close second place at 15% of all of Checkpoint's customers. So, I mean, it really is prevalent. It's amazing. And how does the crypto mining deal with the ad blockers? Well, not surprisingly, because again, the bad guys are as clever as the good guys. We have discussed the state of the art means for botnets avoiding having their command and control server domains commandeered and taken over. And that's the so-called domain name generation algorithms, where even when the malware is reverse engineered, what happens is that based on time of day, which the networks are able to obtain from network time or the system they're on and verify it and so forth. I mean, it's easy to know when it is. They generate pseudo-random domain names, like a bunch of them, and like all at once. Now, like 100. And the idea is that, as we've discussed before, the white hats have to acquire all of those domains if they want to block them all, because only one of them needs to respond to the botnet, which is happy to try them all. So it's a very clever way of hugely upping the ante. And the fact is, I think it was the Conficker worm that was one of the early botnets that did this. It is still in operation because it uses this technique, and it is prohibitively expensive for any group to constantly be having to preemptively register a large block of domains, which are changing constantly. And I mean, you just the bad guys, similar to like DDoS attacks, for which there's really no good defense, have similarly found a way of solving the, this is the domain that this botnet uses. We'll just stomp on it and cut off communication. Well, not surprisingly, this same technique has now come to cryptocurrency mining, where it is no longer the case that ad blockers can simply block www.coinhive.com in order to block the scripts. Now, the domains are being generated with algorithms based on time, and they are constantly changing with the mining script being sourced from domains which are unpredictable moving forward. So we're seeing a technique that was developed earlier for a different application now being moved, and unfortunately was powerful and successful, now being used to thwart simple domain name based ad blocking. That doesn't work for keeping those sorts of scripts off of machines now. The only thing I can see that is going to work is people starting to become much more aware than they are now about their CPU usage and utilization. I'm looking at it right now. I have TaskMan running in the tray, minimized, showing the little square that's all green. But when my CPU starts getting used, or four of them, it's a quad machine, it comes up. So I can sort of see what's going on. And I would imagine at some point someone will create something that alerts someone if one particular process over some length of time is never letting go of the machine. Of course, then the counter attack or the countermeasure for that would be for the miner to periodically stop mining and then go and then start up again in order to look more like the kind of process that you might expect to see. So it's a mess. And it's going to be with us for a long time because it makes money. Speaking of which, two different groups, the Impervia crew and the SANS security folks, have been keeping an eye out for other miningware. And the Imperva crew discovered new cryptojacking malware targeting Redis servers. Redis is a BSD-based caching server platform that offers services similar to Memcache, runs on a compatible piece of hardware, but is unfortunately exploitable. And then there's also more cryptojacking going on targeting Windows-based servers. The SANS security folks spotted a different campaign which targets the Apache Solr, which is a large, scalable, searchable, open-source database system. And as usual, these are publicly accessible, in all cases, publicly accessible server platforms, which are essentially we can sort of think of them as in several cases, they have memcached sort of services, but they're not being used for denial of service attacks. They're being used to mine cryptocurrency. So again, the pressure that this creates to mint dollars or whatever denomination of currency is causing bad guys to come up with new ways of exploiting existing problems. And in every case, they are exploiting previously patched, in some cases by a year or two, vulnerabilities which are well known, have been long fixed, but there are servers still operating that have not been updated, and the malware, which sort of ignored these services or servers until now, well, now there's a reason to get in there. So they're running their cryptocurrency mining on them. And I had a couple stats also. In the case of the Redis servers, last month, a different campaign than the one that was seen, but also against actually both Redis and OrientDB servers, netted nearly $1 million. So this is the other reason you want as we know, the stronger the machine is, the more muscle its CPU has, the better the rate of cryptocurrency mining. But this demonstrates that, whoever it was behind that campaign who took the time and trouble to find and infect those two classes of servers, the Redis and the OrientDB servers, during a month netted just shy of $1 million. So this is why we're seeing a lot of this happening and expect to in the future. It pays off. And although I don't have a dollar figure, the SANS researchers determined that around 1,777 infections of that Apache Solr had succeeded between the end of February and March 8th. So February 28th to March 8th. So essentially 9 days in order to find 1,777 Apache Solr instances and set up cryptocurrency mining there.
Apache Solr Amazing. Was the plugin used by Equifax that was unpatched that got them breached.
Yep, makes sense. Cool. Also, last week, exactly a week ago, on March 6th, Microsoft detected a rapidly spreading cryptocurrency malware, which successfully infected nearly 500,000 Windows machines within 12 hours. A week ago, Windows Defender suddenly detected more than 80,000 instances of a malware named Dofoil, or also known as Smoke Loader, which was dropping a cryptocurrency miner as its payload to mine Electronium coins.
This is like another, a Marvel Universe.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. Electronium. That's a cool name,
of course. Yeah, it's like
go get me some Electronium.
Unobtainium.
Rub some Electronium on that. That'll help it. Yeah. Anyway, by the time Windows Defender could respond, nearly 400,000 additional infections were in place. But they weren't local. They were rapidly spreading across Russia, Turkey, and Ukraine. The question, which has so far gone unanswered by Microsoft, is how such a large audience became infected in such a short period. We don't know that, but we do know that Defender shot off alarms, and then Microsoft was able to then update Defender and get it to help deal with that infection. Okay, and one last cryptocurrency mining story, and then we'll take our final break. And that is, believe it or not, Leo, there's a currency miner in the Mac App Store, and Apple seems okay.
Calendar
with
2,
it.
Yeah.
Calendar
well,
2, it's exactly.
Because it says it's in the features. You can turn it on.
Correct. Yeah. In fact, the next page of the show notes, I have a screenshot of Calendar 2's features. Now, it was a little controversial. Well, in fact, the author has now said he's going to back out of that. But he thought, hey, I'm going to declare it up front. I'm going to allow people to have all of the Calendar 2 features if they're willing, as he says, to unobtrusively generate cryptocurrency in the background.
That's actually a good deal. It's otherwise $18 to do that.
Yeah. So you could pay once for $18 to unlock all new and future calendar features, or you could go the pay-as-you-go route at 99 cents per month to subscribe to unlock all new and future calendar features, or just run with the totally free version and you just get the basic stuff. So it was a little controversial because it was enabled, the free cryptocurrency mining version was what you got by default without explicit notice. So the critiques I saw suggested that, well, he really should have made it very clear, like, you know, asked users, do you want to unlock all the features if we just do a little mining in the background? Also, it was supposed to be in the background. What the author now says is that there were problems with the library that they got from a third party, whom he's blaming for these problems. It was only supposed to take 10 to 20% of the CPU. On the other hand, we know the more CPU you take, the more you get. So for whatever reason, whether it was deliberate or not, it was using way more of the system, which of course brought the device, the iOS or the Mac apparently really slowed it down. And he was mining without permission. And apparently, even if the user did not give permission, then, like, due to some glitch in the library, we believe it was causing a problem. I think that's all true because this ended up not going over well, and he's now said he's going to remove that. But again, as you said, Leo, if it were able to be unobtrusive, I guess maybe only mining while you're using the calendar, I'm assuming that's the case, it's not just running in the background all the time. And it's an alternative to paying money, $18, maybe it makes sense.
Why not?
I think we're going to see more of this. To me, as I've said, as an alternative to web-based advertising, if it's efficient, that's the quest. And in fact, you know, I've got a really fun story about one more final cryptocurrency story, but let's wait till after our final break, and then I'm going to.
Okay, I like this one. Yeah, actually, I at some point I would maybe we do it off the air. I don't want people to think I'm pumping it, but I probably told you, I use an open source project called Keybase to keep track, not to generate my PGP keys, but to distribute it. You can follow people's keys. It lets you
Keybase.io.
Yeah, it's really great. The guys who did that have partnered and are now being funded by a cryptocurrency called Stellar Lumens. And they believe it solves a lot of the problems Bitcoin has, particularly transaction speed and cost. It also is much lighter on the environment. You know, Bitcoin now uses more power than Poland. Bitcoin miners and proof, you know, it's going to, even if miners stop, it's going to be proof of work for transactions, and Bitcoin really isn't very efficient. So Stellar is designed to be fast, light, efficient, and the Keybase guys are going to start using it for global transactions of some kind. I think it's very interesting. Banks are starting to use it. So at some point, I'd love to talk to you about the idea of maybe a better designed cryptocurrency having all the benefits that we've talked about before of blockchain and Bitcoin without the downsides of Bitcoin. Ethereum seems to have many of the same problems too. So anyway, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about a little company back in the late 90s, small company, wanted to provide services on the internet and realized that they needed a database system. So they built their own. And as the company grew, the database system grew. As its capabilities grew to match the company's, it became one of the most amazing systems ever. A system that scales across millions of machines, runs petabytes of data every day.
What is it?
It's the database that runs Google. And you can use it too. Google Cloud Spanner. A few years ago, they decided, we're going to make this available. We've got this down. Look, who's better at scaling? Who's better at scaling than Google? And Cloud Spanner was designed by Google for Google, and they've been using it for more than a decade, to power Google services.
And now you can use it for your services too. It's Google's Cloud Spanner from the Google Cloud platform. It's the only horizontally scalable, strongly consistent, relational database service. That's really important. You know, there's times when you need an SQL-type database. You need schema. You need SQL query language. You need consistency. You need high availability, horizontal scalability, automatic replication. No one does it like Google Spanner. The Cloud Spanner is amazing. And if your application, if you're, you know, you need a strong, scalable, mission-critical relational database service, there's no better than Cloud Spanner from Google Cloud Platform. Built from the ground up and battle-tested at Google for strong consistency, high availability at global scale, 5 nines availability. They have an SLA with 5 nines, but because they need 5 nines. No planned downtime, enterprise-grade security, multi-language support, client libraries in every language, C#, Go, Java, Node.js, PHP, Python, Ruby. There's a JDBC driver for connectivity with other popular third-party database tools. And the pricing, given all you're getting, wow, it's amazing. Simple and predictable. That's important, too. Learn more about Cloud Spanner at their site. We'll give you the Google URL shortener. G.co, that's their shortener. Can't get shorter than three letters. G.co/getspanner. Go there today to find out more. It's actually, Eric Brewer is a genius. This stuff is amazing. It's a no-compromise relational database system that scales virtually infinitely from, of course, the company that made it for them. Cloud Spanner from Google, g.co/getspanner. And we thank Cloud Spanner from Google Cloud Platform for their support. And Google Cloud Platform is really kind of amazing. And if you need these tools, you got to check it out. g.co/getspanner. They said, we want to talk to the geekiest people in your audience. Who would that be? I said,
I love that little animation.
Isn't that
cool? Really
cool? Yeah. It's to show that it's horizontally scaled, right? I mean, globally scaled, but it had to be. It's, you know, this is what Google is running on, right?
Yeah. And isn't it funny how a funny name can just become adopted? Like when we first heard Google, it was like, what?
I know.
Google.
It's like baby talk.
And now it's just like, it's
part Google.
Of our world.
It's Google.
Life.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
So, okay, our last cryptocurrency story is just too funny. Well, fun. Get this.
Yeah.
A French heater manufacturing company, and I don't know how to pronounce their name, Carnot, Q-A-R-N-O-T. We'll go
Carnot.
With
Carnot. I'd say Carnot, yeah.
Carnot.
Yeah.
Is actually selling, or at least offering to sell, we don't really know how many people are doing this, a cryptocurrency mining based space heater. So
it's got an intuitive interface.
It does. It'll talk to your smartphone. It's got little LEDs it's
the first crypto heater.
It's the QC1. Crypto heater QC1.
It's noiseless.
And their site says, oh yes, noiseless, no fans, no moving parts. So it's a little pricey. Yes, it is 2,900 euros, which is at $3,600. It's able to hash at 60 mega hashes per second.
Is that good?
It makes Ethereum and at current hash rates, difficulty and Ethereum trading rate, that would be about $120 per month. I don't know.
And they don't electricity not included.
Right. And so it's not going to probably pay for itself. Mm. You know, I mean, if you sit on it, your butt will get warm. So on their website, they say, earn cryptocurrency while heating. The heat of your QC1 is generated by two graphics cards They have a pair of Nitro Radeon RX 580s with 8 gig of RAM, which, as I said, is able to solve Ethereum at 60 mega hashes per second.
Wow.
They say two graphics cards embedded in the device and mining cryptocurrencies or blockchain transactions while heating. You create money. You can watch in real time how crypto markets are trending on your mobile app and on your QC1 LEDs. It's got a little strip of LEDs, I guess, and it says noiseless high-end design, the QC1 crypto heater. It's hard to even say with a straight face. Yes, it's a crypto heater. Is the only one in the market. Imagine that. To be perfectly noiseless. Maybe there's some noisy ones. It doesn't embed any mobile part. No fans, no hard drives. This system, developed by Corno, is IP protected. Meaning intellectual property, I'm sure. So they came up with the idea, and they're just going to sit on it. Well, or maybe not, depending on how hot it gets. Intuitive interface designed as a plug-and-mine device. You just plug it in and hook it to your Wi-Fi, and off it goes. Maybe defraying the cost of heating your home a little bit. The problem is, it's certainly now – where you're using a pair of strong GPUs, your efficiency makes sense. But again, $3,600 US for a space heater, I don't know. Don't know if that quite cuts it. But give them an A for coming up with the idea. Okay. I mentioned that tomorrow, March 14th, is the first day of the 2018 Pwn to Own conference up in Canada. This is its 12th annual competition. We've been covering them since 2007. So Leo, probably for as long as the podcast has been going since that we're in our 12th year also. And we've had a lot of fun with the Pwn to Own conferences, the results over the years. This year, there's 5 categories: virtualization, web browsers, enterprise applications, servers, and Microsoft, that is one of the co-hosts along with VMware this year, a sponsor, is the fifth category, is a special Microsoft Windows Insider Preview Challenge category, where they figure out with what the S for Windows 10S is actually supposed to stand for. No, I'm kidding. I don't know. The main backer or the organizer is Trend Micro's Zero Day Initiative, ZDI. And as I said, the partners for the event are Microsoft and VMware. As a consequence of them and other sponsors, up to $2 million in U.S. cash and prizes will be awarded.
Wow, that's huge.
It is huge. It's getting significant. Microsoft offers a Windows Insider Preview Challenge that tests their latest pre-release offerings combined with their configuration on their hardware, and the title Master of Pwn will be awarded to the team with the most points at the end of the contest. And so I thought there were a couple interesting things in there in the Zero Day Initiative announcement. They said, since its inception in 2007, Pwn to Own has increased the challenge level at each new competition. And this year is no different, they wrote. Web browsers return as a target. Yes, it's a fan favorite, folks. As do virtual machine guest-to-host escapes. Enterprise applications remain as targets for this year, and for 2018, Outlook, oh boy, makes its Pwn to Own debut. In years past, Outlook would have just been shredded. It'll be interesting to see how it fares. They said our virtualization category grows by 2 as Oracle becomes a target, and the Windows Insider Preview Challenge includes brand new targets for their virtualization-based security stack. server targets expand this year as well. Apache was included in last year's event and is joined this year by Nginx, OpenSSL, and this is going to be really interesting competition, and Windows SMB server. Oops. Over the years, we've seen some groundbreaking research demonstrated, so we can't wait to see, they write, what contestants bring this year. However, this year, there will be no hacking entrants from the previous year's winning country.
Oh.
China's government has decided to keep its security researchers home.
Mm-hmm.
And as a new policy, Chinese researchers will not be attending remote events. Now, my first thought was that this might be to prevent them from being detained, as we know Marcus Hutchins was after last summer's Black Hat conference in Las Vegas, where he was nabbed at the McLaren airport as he was attempting to return to London, I think it was. Brian Gorenk, who is the director of Trend Micro Zero Day Initiative, said there have been regulatory changes in some countries that no longer allow participation in global exploit contests, such as Pwn to Own and Capture the Flag competitions. And although he didn't explicitly in this quote mention it, he was referring specifically to China. So there will be no Chinese research teams at Pwn to Own this year, which will likely be felt since for the last several years, the Chinese teams dominated the competition. So I think it's sort of sad, because they've got excellent hacking skills, although I suppose for the people they were competing against, having China held back, so it sort of shifts the balance. So it'll be interesting to see who the winners are when China is not present. Prior year Chinese winners were contacted and asked for comment, but none would remark other than to indicate that they would not be attending the competitions. And in another little bit of Chinese-related news, a U.S. threat intelligence firm known as Recorded Future has spotted that the Chinese equivalent of our CVE database, we'd often talk about CVE, that's the Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures database, which is located at cve.mitre.org. China has one known as the CNNVD, the Chinese National Vulnerabilities Database, which is similarly meant to be, open kimono and available and accessible. Anyway, this firm has discovered that China has been retroactively manipulating the data in their own Chinese National Vulnerabilities Database, basically playing fast and loose with the facts and altering the database to conceal the influence of the Chinese Ministry of State Security. They produced a report with four key judgments. They said the CNNVD altered the original publication dates in its public database for at least 267 vulnerabilities that they identified as statistical outliers in their research, which was published in November of 2017. They wrote, "We assessed in November that CNNVD had a formal vulnerability evaluation process in which high-threat CVEs were evaluated for their operational utility by the MSS, the Ministry of State Security, before publication, and that the publication lag was one way to identify vulnerabilities that the MSS was likely considering for use in offensive cyber operations." Now, in all fairness, it's hard to imagine that our own intelligence services in the U.S. aren't, you know, who knows what manipulation is going on. There has been, we have had some reporting of this notion that some of these vulnerabilities are being disclosed to the U.S. government before being made public. So basically a similar operation.
And vice versa. Intel told Lenovo before they told the U.S. government.
Exactly. That was quite controversial. Yes. And although they say here that the that CNNVD's outright manipulation of these dates implicitly confirmed their this recorded futures assessment. They said by retroactively changing the original publication dates on these statistical outliers, CNNVD attempted to hide the evidence of this evaluation process, obfuscate which vulnerabilities the MSS may be utilizing, and limit the methods researchers can use to anticipate Chinese advanced persistent threat behavior. And then they conclude saying this large-scale manipulation of vulnerability data undermines trust in the CNNVD process and could compromise security operations relying solely on the CNNVD for that information. Although, again, you know, this our own CVE database is similarly public and probably contains virtually all the same information. I did want to note just in passing that last Friday, U.S. District Judge Lucy Koh denied in part a motion by Verizon, which is the owner of Yahoo, to dismiss a case brought by plaintiffs who are suing Yahoo for failing to adequately protect their user security and neglecting to respond to known and dangerous vulnerabilities in a timely manner. We know from our previous reporting that and you know, widely covered in the industry that December 2016, Yahoo first disclosed the truth of the 2013 breach, which they said compromised the credentials of a billion of their users. And then just last October, that assessment was revised to 3 billion impacted accounts. Judge Koh wrote in her ruling on Friday, quote, plaintiffs explained that had they known about the inadequacy of these security measures, they would have taken measures to protect themselves. Plaintiffs' allegations are sufficient to show that they would have behaved differently had defendants disclosed the security weaknesses of the Yahoo mail system, which it now appears was known to Yahoo. And you know, and we at the time we talked about how Yahoo just decided not to follow the urgent requests of their own security staff to fix problems, but rather spend their resources elsewhere. So it'll be interesting to see where, you know, how this settles out. It is significant, I think, that Yahoo is being held to account because other companies are certainly taking, you know, are keeping an eye on this. And finally, this stunned me, Leo. I was very surprised by this. I have a picture of a donut chart. We used to just have pie charts. Now we have donut charts, you know, for some reason, I don't know why. But this is the news is, according to a report that McAfee just released yesterday, McAfee analyzed the source of internet email spam internet wide. And I was amazed by the distribution. Two botnets, one called Neckers, NECURS, and Gamut, GAMUT. Those two botnets alone account for 97% of the internet's spam, email spam. I'm amazed. So this donut chart, this Neckers is by far the biggest at generating 60% by volume in the fourth quarter of last year. of all of the spam email, and Gamut is at 37%. So together, 97%. And then there, the other three are Lethic, Dark Mailer, and then random others, each with only 1% respectively. It's just so in McAfee's report, they said for most of these months, Neckers has spent its time churning out what they called lonely girl spam lures for adult websites, pump and dump schemes, and delivering ransomware payloads. Overall, nearly 2 out of 3 spam emails sent in the last quarter of 2017 were sent from the infrastructure of this mammoth, writes McAfee, botnet. Second on the list was the Gamut botnet, also built on Windows machines infected with malware that hijacks Windows to send out spam. Gamut, which, while smaller in size when compared to Neckers, they write, had previously been more active in the third quarter, sending more spam than Neckers. However, they reversed positions. In Q4, Gamut activity went down, but the botnet still accounted for 37% of all email spam compared to Neckers' 60%. They wrote most of Gamut's email subjects were related to job offer-themed phishing and money mule recruitment, which is tricking people to buy products with stolen money and sending the products to crooks, relaying money from hijacked bank accounts to malicious accounts and so forth. But I'm just amazed. Two botnets, two massive Windows botnets are generating 97% of the spam on the internet. Wow. I had
amazing.
Go ahead. Amazing. Yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah. Surprising distribution. I'm just stunned. It's like they put everybody else out of business.
Yeah.
In the spam business.
Yeah.
I got a nice note from at the end of February on the 27th from Eric in Wisconsin. The subject was yet another SRSTD story. And then he says his first line in the email is SRSTD equals SpinRite saves the day. He said, Steve, first of all, thank you, all caps, for your great SpinRite product. He says, I've been meaning to pass along a story of yet another of SpinRite's successes for me for quite some time. I've often thought this may be just another run-of-the-mill testimonial of how SpinRite has saved the day. But I thought I would share it anyway and let you be the judge. And, of course, I'm always I'm happy to have those and to be able to share them with our listeners. He says, besides, I had to say thanks. A dentist's office was referred to me for support when there, and then he has angle brackets, insert well-known brand here, NAS device, probably a Synology, just based on what he says later. An NAS device was indicating multiple drive failures. Sounds like they'd neglected it for quite a while, and they could no longer access any of their data for the office because the NAS would no longer boot. Of course, I was asked about their current backup process and was shocked, he says in quotes, parens, not really, to hear they had been meaning to address that hole in their process for some time. So, no backups. This particular NAS was bootable from its USB port, he said. So I booted it into SpinRite and let SpinRite go to work. By now, everyone knows that a happy ending usually ensues, and that is an understatement in this case. SpinRite plowed through the entire array and upon reboot was happily serving data again. For safekeeping, I was able to get a copy of their never backed up data off the NAS. Needless to say, they were ecstatic about the recovery and also now have a good local and offsite backup process in place. Well, clearly Eric has been listening to the podcast and knows that, you know, the importance of doing that, and obviously is up to speed on how to recover data and then keep it safe. He says, I did recommend to them to go purchase their own copy of SpinRite to express their satisfaction, and I believe they have done so. Thank you again for all, in all caps, that you do. Look forward to listening to about 350 more SN episodes. Yes, up until we finish with three digits. He says, keep up the good work, Eric in Wisconsin. So, Eric, thank you for sharing that with our with me and allowing me to do so with our listeners. And so finally, what was going to be the topic of today's podcast was to follow up on last week's podcast where we introduced the our listeners to what had just happened in the world, which was the discovery that there were tens of thousands of open, exposed to the public internet servers running memcached, a daemon, a server process, which was listening on port 11211 and would both receive data over that port for local caching and then based on a tag that that data was tagged to, when it later asked for it, would send it back out. The problem is, since it is that it was bound by default to both UDP and TCP, which, by the way, has been changed in the updated version. Now it's only bound to TCP, which is a minimal change. But on the other hand, we know how few of these are probably going to be updated over time. So these big available caches are going to be sitting on the public internet for quite a while. Now, for those who do update, then it will no longer be publicly exposing a UDP port. That's important because it is trivial to change the source IP of a UDP packet in order to cause the memcache server to believe somebody else asked for this big blob of data. As I mentioned at the top of the show, it is possible to create a bandwidth amplification of 51,000x. So just crazy. And in fact, I didn't mention last week that there have been ransom demands being made of the sites that are being DDoSed, and the ransom demand is in the data that the site is being DDoSed with. If you're being flooded with that much traffic, it's unlikely that many of those demands actually make it through your pipe to you, because it's going to crash upstream routers and just wreak havoc on your system, because these attacks are so massive. But I think that sounds like that the attackers had a little bit of a sense of humor. What we have seen as the picture of the week at the top of the show notes showed was predictably a massive increase in these attacks in just the last 10 days. And this was a report that ended several days ago. So essentially in the week that followed the emergence of this, over 15,000 DDoS attacks based on this memcached service were used to attack 7,100 sites over that period of time. Also, since then, the concept, of course, has went wild. There is now publicly available, freely available, downloadable attack code. So although this was never a difficult attack to launch, and I'm sure a lot of coders who are capable of coding their own attack tools did so immediately, now even that's not necessary. There is downloadable turnkey DRDOS, a distributed reflection denial of service attack code, available, where you simply run the tool, you put in the target of the IP address of the target you wish to attack. That tool goes out to Shodan and looks up, gets the current list of known to Shodan memcached service IPs and begins filling the cache and bouncing UDP packets requesting that cache be dumped on whatever victim was targeted. So that no longer requires any coding. That stuff is freely available on the internet. And the last little bit of news is that there has been some attempt at considering mitigation. There are two other commands other than here's a tag, send me back the blob. There is an empty your cache command, and there is a shutdown command. I haven't seen anybody suggesting the use of the shutdown command. And of course, it would bring if the memcached service was in active use by the site, having it shut down would bring it to the attention of the site owners pretty quickly. But there is a flush the cache, and I've seen some suggestions that if a site was under attack, that the flush the cache command could be sent proactively back to their array of sites that are attacking it. Unfortunately, that's like 17,000 different sites services at least. And the moment you start flushing, then the other sites are still attacking you, and the flushed cache can begin to be refilled. So the problem is not that there's any practical solution to these attacks. It's that we have publicly exposed caches now available on the internet that are by default bound to both UDP and TCP. UDP trivial to spoof, and so as would have been predicted, massive attacks are now underway leveraging this. The only thing that I've seen is that some big providers like Cloudflare are throttling all traffic across their border across port 11211. That's the well-known port, as I mentioned, where this service is running. So by throttling that traffic, at least that prevents both outgoing requests for cache data to remote public servers and prevents the data from getting through their border. On the other hand, the bandwidth flood will still hit their border and cause a massive attack. So at this point, all we can do is keep an eye on this and see what the trend is moving forward. You know, this isn't crypto mining. It's not making anyone any money. It's unless ransoms are being paid. It does make DDoS, very, very potent DDoS attacks, far more powerful and easy to create than they were before. So maybe it shifts the balance, or maybe this will die down after a while and people will go back to trying to install cryptocurrency mining, which is the new trend on the internet, making some money that you can exchange for real dollars. We'll see. But the big story, of course, is AMD's very, very short notice of some serious problems. I'm sure we will have much more to say about that on the podcast next week.
You bet. Or, as some speculate, it's just some company trying to dump AMD stock since they didn't publish exploits, right? I mean, is that conceivable? So awful lot of work to put in.
And as I said, I was tempted to push this off to next week until I read through their research, which is very compelling.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I think that's not the case. And does anyone know what has happened to AMD stock in the meantime?
It's funny. Not much.
Yeah, I'm not an owner of any stock at all. Yeah. So
you don't have any stock at all. I mean, you have must have mutual funds or something. You have investments.
I'm a municipal bond owner.
Oh, there you
that's a good investment. Solution. Long time ago, back when the interest rates were much higher. So,
I'm just check the AMD stock price. Yeah, it's up 1%.
Yeah, well, it'll be again. I don't know if the news has hit mainstream. It's maybe there's already some vulnerability fatigue from Spectre and Meltdown, where it's like, another one of these big problems. You know, we dealt with the one at the beginning of the year. We'll deal with this one. Who knows? Anyway, it looked absolutely credible to me. We'll I'm sure I'll have much more mature coverage, because much more will be known by a week from now.
There was a bit of a sell-off when the show began, but it's flattened out now in the after-hours trading. So, it's hard to say that the stock has been hurt much.
Yeah.
It was going down for a while. All right, Steve. Somebody said Steve owns all of Fresno. He owns all their convertible debt, yes. Thank you, Steve. Steve Gibson's at grc.com. That's his website. He tweets at SGGRC. You'll find him on the Twitter there. You can leave long DMs for him if you want, if you have comments. I left you a tweet, a funny article I read that might make a good photo of the week next week, but Steve always likes more input like that. You go to grc.com, you'll find SpinRite, that fine tool for dentists and hard drive users everywhere. All you need to do is go to grc.com, pick up a copy, and you'll be ready to test and recover hard drives to your little heart's content. There's plenty of other stuff there, too. Lots of freebies, including, of course, this show, 64 kilobit audio and fine handwritten transcripts from Elaine Ferris, all there, searchable, too, and all the 654 episodes. You can also find audio and video at our site, twit.tv/SN, or subscribe. You'll get your show as soon as it's ready on your favorite podcast platform. Scary Now's been around for a little while, so we're on almost every program has us. You can even ask your voice-activated device to listen to Security Now, and most of the time that works pretty well. I think that's it for the day, for the week, but we will see you. We will convene again next Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific.
Oh, I'm sure we'll have more news,
Eastern,
my friend.
2:30 UTC. Thank you, Steve. See you then.
Thanks, Leo. Security Now.